Ladies and gentlemen, start your stopwatches because you're listening to the Dispatches on the Clock, and that means we're going to spend the next 15 minutes or less, or maybe more today actually, talking about a brand new New Zealand Media Council complaint against stuff.co.nz and the concerns that have been raised by the Media Council about Stuff's lack of balance in their coverage of transgenderism. I think the best way to proceed with today's episode is actually just to jump straight into the official Media Council complaint and read from there. You may well have seen the Stuff coverage about this Media Council ruling, but the Stuff coverage is inadequate, I think, because it lacks a lot of important details. I'm kind of not surprised, because when you see the full details of this complaint, it doesn't paint Stuff in a particularly good light. And so let's just jump straight in. Here's the basic overview. On the 10th of June 2022, the Nelson Mail published a story headlined "Transgender Conference Sparks Fierce National Backlash." Even that headline is loaded against the people organising the event. The story also appeared on Stuff. Fern Hickson complains that the article breached Principle 1, which is accuracy, fairness, and balance, and that Stuff has breached the same principle over a long period in its coverage of transgender issues. Fern Hickson complained about the 10 June story, but also about Stuff's overall coverage of transgender issues, which she said was clearly partisan. Stuff embraced many transgender beliefs as if they were facts, she said, citing examples including that it had replaced the word sex with the nebulous word gender in the organisation's discrimination standard. And that's a really, really important point. And I don't think Stuff is alone in this. I think this is a problem across the board with mainstream media coverage of this issue. Right now, there is a complete lack of journalism going on. In a lot of cases, what we are actually seeing is active advocacy and activism, which is trying to defend the ideology and to give a platform to proponents of the ideology with very little in the way of challenge or pushback. I think you would have to be probably naive or a little bit dishonest to deny that that's the reality of what's actually happening on the ground at the moment. Ms. Hickson said she had audited Stuff's coverage. This is an important bit, by the way. She had audited Stuff's coverage from January 2020 to June 2022. So that's over 2 years. That is basically 2.5 years of coverage that she has audited. She said Stuff had reported at least 58 times from a transgender supportive perspective and only once from a perspective that questioned transgender beliefs. And I have no reason to doubt that that audit is actually a correct accounting, or close to, if not everything that there is to find that Stuff may have published on this. And the reason why I'm saying that is when you get to the section of the complaint where Stuff responds, there doesn't appear to be any pushback at all on that audit. And that probably indicates, well, would seem to indicate to me anyway, that Stuff knows that this is an accurate accounting for the complete lack of balance in this coverage. 58 times from a transgender supportive perspective and only once from a perspective that questioned the ideology. Transitioning was glorified, she said, and long-term side effects such as sterility and loss of sexual function were not mentioned, she said. And this is important. I was actually having a conversation with some people the other day and they had no idea about these particular side effects. And that shows you how important it is to actually get good, honest, open and transparent coverage of all the issues, not just partial. Stuff had ignored international stories covering concerns about the treatment of gender dysphoria. A responsible, balanced media would delve into these issues, Ms. Hickson said. Regarding the 10 June story, Ms. Hickson said it was unfair that she had been named in a pejorative Stuff and Nelson Mail story without being asked for comment. As well as being labelled incorrectly as a detransitioner, she was the only speaker named, linking her to the claims that the conference was outrageous, quote-unquote, and wrong, quote-unquote. The online story was changed to remove the detransitioner error, but the correction published in the Nelson Mail was not satisfactory, as there was no apology, The correction only said she was a teacher and did not clearly state she was not a detransitioner. The Nelson Mail offered the opportunity to submit an opinion piece to provide balance, but staff editors deemed the piece she offered pejorative and prejudiced, and a rewritten piece was similarly rejected. So this is an important point, and this is something staff have not mentioned in their coverage, that they offered her the opportunity to write an opinion piece to give balance, because obviously she'd complained about the lack of balance. She does the right thing. She writes an opinion piece, and the first version, they come back and they say, no, I'm sorry, that's pejorative, it's prejudiced, and so you can't have that being published. She goes back and produces a rewritten version that is also rejected. This tells me, and there's no sort of example or citing of what it was that they considered to be offensive, but I am highly suspicious that there wasn't at least the solid meat of something balanced that ordinary, everyday, common sense people would say, yeah, that was balanced, it should have been published. I think this is probably them going into bat to defend, once again, the ideology. Staff offered to run the original story again with the addition of quotes from Ms. Hickson, but she rejected this offer, saying would only repeat the untruths about the conference and besmirch my name all over again. And to be fair, that's a very wise call, I think, because it's too late. Once the story is out there, and it's been out there for a couple of days, and you go back and rerun the story, I mean, even if it's been out there for half a day now in the current media consumption environment, the speed at which things move and then transition into the next phase of the news cycle, it used to be sort of a 12 to 24-hour news cycle. That's long gone now. The news can be cycling within an hour or two now. And so what that means is, if you've had a story that's got errors in it, that's already been published online, if you go back and republish a story to fix the original errors, most people are not going to see the second story because they're going to say, well, I've already read the story. I'm not going to go back and reread a story. They're not going to know that you've corrected false information. So it's really, really pointless. There is a big problem here. I've been talking about this for a while. This is something that I think needs to be addressed in a more meaningful and substantive way. I actually think what needs to happen is there needs to be some new law changes around how the media reports story corrections, and I think they should be required to produce some sort of banner at the very top of every single online story that they publish showing exactly the corrections that have been made. So the time, the date, and the actual nature of the correction, so that any person can come and can see how accurate or inaccurate an article was. And what that would also allow us to do is it would also allow us to start tracking various media outlets, because you could start actually collecting and collating that data, and over a 6 month or 12 month period, for example, you could actually show that stuff was consistently less accurate than, say, the New Zealand Herald, or the New Zealand Herald was less accurate than Brendan's Daily Blog, for example. And so you could actually do that because you'd be able to have a trackable measurement there, which would show you how many times they corrected stories, the nature of the corrections, etc. And you could actually produce some detailed reporting about media accuracy that would be really helpful for us, the public, to understand who is reliable and who is not. And I guarantee you it would also start to have an accountability effect on media outlets. And I think there would be a positive outcome. There would be less rushing, less haste, and a little bit more accuracy, I think, in reporting if you knew that you were actually going to be pulled up so clearly for that. The story was also unbalanced and inaccurate, Ms. Hickson said, with no attempt to investigate opposing views or check statements for accuracy. She provided links to other stories and stories that challenged the opinions about transgender issues that dominated the Nelson Mail story. The organisers of the conference had provided a statement on the 17th of June, so that's 7 days later, in response to the 11 June story. She said, I thought it was the 10 June, actually. It started by saying 10 June, so now it's saying 11 June story. Maybe there was a second story there. However, this was not published until the 26th of June. And even then, half the story was devoted to criticism of the conference. So they published it on the 26th of June. Like, the first story, according to this, was the 10th of June. 16 days later, they publish an amended version. And she says even that version over half or half the second story was devoted to criticism of the conference. Now, Stuff responds. I won't read you all of their response, but just a couple of pieces that stick out to me here. Ms. Hickson's assertion that Stuff failed to publish her opinion piece without good reason was disputed by Stuff. Editors decided it did not meet the standards of Stuff's editorial code of practice and ethics regarding diversity, discrimination, and prejudice. Stuff was under no obligation to publish opinion pieces as a right of reply. That's true. They're not. But they did ask her to produce one. She produced one. And then they're saying, well, no, this fails our code of practice and ethics regarding diversity, discrimination, and prejudice. And if that's that code of practice that's embroiled in the whole term of using gender instead of biological sex, etc., you can see why that might create a problem and why, even though they're saying, well, we offered someone the opportunity to have their say, but their say was hateful, they might actually be deeming legitimate criticism as hateful and not publishing it unjustly. So in other words, they're refusing to publish it, they're claiming it's hateful, it's not actually hateful, there is an injustice in that, and there is a lack of balance, and there is dishonesty in the public square as a result. Stuff also addressed Ms. Hickson's more general complaint about what she said was Stuff's long-standing lack of accuracy, fairness, and balance on transgender issues. And this is interesting because they don't actually refute the audit that she's done. What they do is they say this in response. Stuff takes the position that transgender people do exist, Stuff said. Under the New Zealand Human Rights Act, gender identity is protected against discrimination, and we take a human rights standpoint in our reporting on transgender issues. Reporting the views of people who take a prejudiced approach to transgender issues is not providing balance. That is just simply not true at all. That is absolutely not correct. So someone who takes a prejudiced approach, in other words, they say, I disagree, that's a prejudice, right, against something. You say that idea, I'm prejudiced against that ideology. That's enough for you to be labelled and dismissed by Stuff, according to this comment. And that is absolutely shocking. A similar issue arose in the reporting of climate change, where it was not a requirement to include comments from climate change deniers for balance. I mean, we'll get into that point and in a second when we get to the Media Council's response. But what Stuff's doing here is saying, well, this is just like climate change. Stuff said its reporting on transgender issues was impartial. Well, that's clearly not true. They've just actually stated previously, literally just two paragraphs before, that they hold a position on this issue. They have thrown their lot in with the ideology. So to then turn around and say, well, our reporting on these issues is impartial, is just simply not true. But that did not mean giving a platform to voices who deny the very existence of other New Zealanders in harmful and prejudicial ways. The problem here is that term, harmful and prejudicial ways. What do you mean when you say harmful and prejudicial ways? And that's where I guarantee you the problem actually lies. They are using those phrases, those terms, in the broadest way possible as a defense of any critique, any dissent, any challenge to gender constructionist ideology. Stuff considered Ms. Hickson's comments questioning the existence of multiple genders and statements about the dangers of transgender ideology to fall into that category. And that's exactly what I'm saying. This is not legitimate, hateful behavior on her part. It's simply someone questioning an ideology. And thus saying no, to question the ideology is hateful and hurtful and prejudiced. This is very much to be expected. We are living now in the age of what Carl Truman, I think, rightly calls expressive individualism. The individual creates their own identity. Their identity is who they truly are. Effectively, people are constructing themselves in their own image. And to even raise questions about an ideology which they have constructed an identity around is now considered an attack on the very person. There is no separation between person and act anymore because of this ideology. If you act a certain way, you are that action. And to challenge or question the act or the action is to challenge or question you. In fact, your very existence and your very worth. That's the problem with this ideology. And that's why staff, unsurprisingly, are doing what they are doing. They are reflecting and following the dominant ideological era of our age. Ms. Hickson says she was unfairly dealt with because, and this is the media council response here, Ms. Hickson says she was unfairly dealt with because the initial story referred to her as a detransitioner when she was not. The council accepts Stuff's assertion that this was a genuine mistake. The Nelson Mail apologised in an email to Ms. Hickson and the correction was swift. I think it was like 10 p.m. at night. In the complaint, earlier on the complaint, it points out the original coverage was, they were alerted about the flaws in that about 10 p.m. that night, and then the next morning they had made the change. And so the Media Council says that that is a swift enough thing to do. However, what it does do is it shows you here how much misinformation and how prone to misinformation media reporting actually can be. And this is one of the ironies in all of this. The Disinformation Project is rushing around busy hunting for witches under every rock and behind every tree, but what they're not doing is actually keeping an account of misinformation in the biggest, most well-funded, in fact, taxpayer-funded now quite often, institutions and purveyors of information in the public square, and that is the mainstream media. I think if they did that, we would all be quite shocked if there was some accurate coverage and research into how often we are receiving misinformation in the mainstream media. And it seems to me that this particular era of calling her a detransitioner, like they're saying it's a basic mistake, but it seems that this could have been something that would have been easily clarified. And I'm not sure how you end up. It's never really explained how they came to make that mistake. And it seems to me that surely a bit of basic leather work on the part of a journalist would actually be able to correct that. And if you can't correct it because the person doesn't call you back in time, surely you shouldn't actually run an assertion, a positive assertion about a person, unless you know for certain that that is actually correct. But that's a whole other story. However, the correction published in the Nelson Mail was inadequate. So this is the council's ruling, particularly given the fact that the story had given incorrect personal information about a named individual. This is what I was just saying. The correction read, a story published on Saturday about a transgender conference in Nelson said Fern Hickson is a detransitioner. She is a teacher. That's the end of their correction. The council believes the correction should have clearly stated that she was not a detransitioner, removing all ambiguity. This aspect of the complaint is upheld under Principle 12 around corrections, corrections of media stories, not corrections as in the prison system. But here's the thing for me. Again, this is another great example of where if the Disinformation Project actually did some research into the New Zealand media, we would, as I said, I think we would be quite surprised by how often this is going on, because what they've done here is they haven't even provided an accurate correction of the original inaccuracy in the actual story itself. Ms. Hickson also complains that the story is unbalanced, and on the face of it, it is heavily weighted towards those who disapprove of the conference and the views of some who were speaking at it. However, Stuff approached the conference organisers and gave them a reasonable time to respond. The short response was included. It is difficult for news outlets to produce a balanced report if those being criticised are unwilling to put forward their point of view. CATA did respond after the story was published, and their response was included in a second story. Stuff says it was published 9 days after it was received on June 26, with the delay due to several factors. Given the level of criticism in the first story, the council considers it would have been better to have published the second story sooner. I absolutely agree, and I don't think there's much of a justification for that delay. But it is difficult to know with certainty whether this would have been possible. And that's the bit where we sort of end up with this wet bus ticket slap on the wrist going on. There's just not enough teeth, I guess, in the Media Council and their powers to actually demand better accountability. It's like, well, we think they should have published it sooner, but, you know, it's difficult to know whether this would have been possible. I struggle to understand how they couldn't have published it sooner than 16 days after they ran the original story. That to me seems like a disproportionate amount of time. This story did include a robust defence of the conference organisers' position, and so provided a degree of balance. Ms. Hickson asked the Nelson Mail to publish an opinion piece to provide balance, but the paper rejected the pieces she wrote. The council considers editors have the discretion to decide which opinion pieces to publish. That is true. I accept that. However, they invited her to publish, and the problem here is the grounds under which they rejected the publication. That is really, really concerning to me, because it's pretty clear based on their response that they have thrown their lot in with the ideology. They are not journalists on this issue. They are activists, they are ideologues, they are preachers of an ideology. That's what they're doing, and it's pretty clear. And that's the problem, and it's a real shame to me that the Media Council didn't actually even pass any further comment on that particular aspect, because that's the problematic aspect of that rejection of the op-ed. It's not that they chose not to run an op-ed. Of course, they're within their rights to do that. It's the reasons why. That's the problem. The question of whether Stuff's overall approach to transgender issues is biased is more difficult. Stuff takes the view that giving a voice to certain opinions on transgender issues amounts to giving a platform to prejudice and views that might cause harm. The council believes Stuff has the right to take this position. Sure, I totally understand that. However, the question is their definition of harm and prejudice legitimate? That's the problem. That's the real issue here. And I think that's the thing that needs a lot more scrutiny. And by the way, if we had a free, open and robust public square, we could actually have these kind of deeper discussions about the deeper issues. So we could actually go beyond just talking about the gender constructionist ideology and its particular flaws, and we could actually start talking about the whole concept of how we define our terms, the way in which we define our definitions, and then apply those definitions as a tool to restrict the conversation about ideas in the public square. However, coverage of the debate about the treatment of gender dysphoria in children is slightly different. This is a sensitive, complicated, and important topic where there appears to be evolving scientific debate. I would say probably all scientific debate is evolving, isn't it? The council rejects Stuff's argument that it is analogous to climate change. Good on them, because they're right here. In the case of climate change, there is an overwhelming consensus of scientific opinion, whereas on the issue of childhood gender dysphoria, there seems to be a variety of genuinely held and differing opinions internationally. Now, this is a really important point that they're making here, but it also raises a big question. So the point they're making, saying you can't actually make the comparison between gender ideology and climate change, I think is a valid one. But I think also there's a much bigger question here, even for climate change, because this whole notion that, you know, consensus or scientific consensus is the same as an absolutely final and settled, infallible scientific proclamation about the world is one that has been challenged quite considerably in the last couple of years in relation to COVID. Because what we had was people making this sort of bold declaration, you know, don't question the experts, don't question the science, listen to the experts, listen to the science. But this experience of the pandemic has shown us how quickly things can shift. And it also shows us how the knowledge gaps are present. And it's also, I think, raised or started to raise, in some quarters anyway, a very valid and important debate about the question of, well, what does the phrase mean, follow the science? What does that actually mean? What is science? Is science a series of infallible proclamations, or is it a process of trying to actually discern information about the natural world? And it seems to me here they're leaning on, even with the issue of climate change, they're leaning on treating science almost like some sort of clerical practice. You have these high priests who are all in agreement and then make a declaration, and that declaration is basically unassailable. I think realistically, we're not talking here about publishing conspiracy theories, but I think even in the climate space, there is still plenty of room for debate and conversation. And I think not just relating to the any particular sort of scientific questions that are involved in that, but I think also, and more pressingly actually, around policy responses to the science, because that's where there is plenty of scope. You've moved now outside of the science to, well, how do we respond to the science. And that's where a lot of the actual big and I think very important questions really need to be asked. So a great example of this, for example, is the way in which New Zealand has gone out of its way under this government to enact or to push forward with enacting a whole lot of restrictive policies based on climate science. But the debate, and very legitimate debate in all of that, is, well, what is that actually doing? Is that a good idea? Because we might be signaling to the rest of the world how amazing we are at reducing and destroying emissions and all the rest of it. However, on the flip side of that, the contribution that New Zealand makes to emissions globally is so insignificantly tiny that if we actually stopped emitting any CO2 at all, like somehow we were able to do that, no CO2 at all, it wouldn't make a difference. It wouldn't make any difference. And that raises an interesting moral question about policy. Well, how far should you go then? Should you actually enact, is it moral to enact policies that do this kind of thing and then do harm economically and do other harms locally to the people and then just turn around and say, oh, well, it's all part of fighting the good fight. Somebody's got to fight against the climate demons, even if what you're doing has no effect on the climate demons. And so there's lots of questions, I think, that need to be debated. But what you've got with stuff on the climate issue is they've thrown their lot in, not just on the scientific question, but I think also on policy demands and everything else. And I think that is a glaring question in all of this. And it's a big problem. It points to, again, the way in which the mainstream media now is becoming more and more a political lobby organization that packages information in a way that is supportive of ideologies and ideas or policies that they have already bought into and want you to buy into as well. Ms. Hickson asserts that the balance of Stuff's coverage is firmly in favour of the transgender supportive perspective. The council does not have the resources to carry out its own research to verify this, but hopes Stuff and other media outlets will consider whether they are taking a balanced approach overall. And the fact that Stuff didn't refute her analysis tells me that her analysis is probably accurate, if not pretty close to being accurate. It's possible that she may have missed one or two stories, but based on what I've seen and the behaviour of Stuff journalists, just look at the way that they have conducted themselves around the Bethlehem College debacle, the targeted, orchestrated campaign where they are platforming and working hand in glove with activists to target the Christian community by targeting Bethlehem College in the way that they have done. And that tells me, I think, that the fact this, what I've seen with my own eyes, and the fact that they didn't refute her audit tells me that she's probably audited things pretty accurately. And this is where the Media Council's warning is really, really important. Have a listen to this. This is what they say. It is important that all reasonable views are allowed to be heard given the seriousness of the matters under consideration. Remember that point because that's the really important sentence. Despite these reservations, the council believes that there is insufficient evidence to uphold a complaint under Principle 1, about an ongoing bias here, and trusts that Stuff and other media outlets will keep a watching brief on developments in this area and cover it in a balanced manner. Now, that, as far as Media Council powers go, that is probably the most stern and serious warning, I guess, that they could give based on the powers that are open to them. The really important point there, though, as I said, is this sentence. It is important that all reasonable views are allowed to be heard given the seriousness of the matters under consideration. And that's the crux of the matter. The problem is that Stuff is not doing that. They are an advocacy organisation, effectively, on this particular issue. They have thrown their lot in with the ideology and the ideologues. They are platforming, they are defending them, and they are silencing people who want to make legitimate challenges and present legitimate dissent to this particular ideology. And that is really, really concerning. In one sense, it is really positive to see the New Zealand Media Council making these statements and have them highlighting that there's a problem here. On the flip side of that, though, the reality is that without much in the way of increased powers of accountability, there's not going to be much of a change, I suspect. But it is important, I think, to be aware that we are not receiving full and accurate, balanced information on this issue. To many of you, that will be no surprise. But I think it's important perhaps for maybe your friends and family who haven't yet understood the nature of how issues are being presented and perhaps the bias that they're often contending with, this media ruling could be a good place to actually start a conversation with them and to sort of highlight to them and say, look, you know, things are not as they often seem, and it's important to be aware of that. And like I said, I think if the Disinformation Project was actually doing its job properly, they would be examining the largest purveyors on a regular daily basis, the most well-funded purveyors of ongoing misinformation and accurate information that gets out into the public square, and that is the mainstream media. It would be absolutely fascinating and probably a little bit frightening, I think, if we discovered just how often inaccuracies were being thrust out into the public square and into the minds of ordinary everyday people. And why it matters, I think, in regards to this particular issue is that when you have got a media outlet that is acting like a Pravda outlet, which is just preaching ideology at people, it is actually shaping the culture. It's not journalism. People are not being challenged to think critically about the ideology. They are not even given the opportunity to hear critical thought about the ideology. They are effectively being educated to accept and embrace in a completely unquestioning way all that is put forward by these particular ideologues. Right, let's finish with today in history. And this one seems highly appropriate given the Christmas season. And if you've been into a supermarket or a shopping mall in the last week or so, you'll probably now be aware that not only are the Christmas decorations up, but the Christmas music has started, the muzak has started playing on loop. And so this Today in History moment seems rather appropriate. November the 25th, 1984, Band-Aid recorded for Ethiopia. When Boomtown rat Bob Geldof watched a BBC TV report on the famine in Ethiopia, he was so appalled at what he saw that he resolved to do something about it. The results of that something were seen today when an extraordinary gathering of British rock stars gathered at Sam Studios, by the way, it was more than British rock stars, in London to record Do They Know It's Christmas. Those who turned up free of charge to sing the song written by Geldof and Ultravox member Mike Urie included Phil Collins, Sting, George Michael, Bono and Boy George. The single will be released on December 7th and all of the proceeds will go directly to Ethiopian famine relief. And the rest was history, my friends, wasn't it? That's why you hear that song, Do They Know It's Christmas, constantly on loop whenever you enter a supermarket or a mall. Today, November the 25th, 1984, it was brought into existence. Thanks for tuning in. If you want to support our work, you can do that at patreon.com/leftfootmedia. $5 or more per month gets you access to our exclusive full-length patrons-only episode of the Dispatches podcast every single week. The link is in today's show notes. Don't forget, live by goodness, truth, and beauty, not by lies, and I will see you next time on the Dispatches. On the Clock is brought to you by Left Foot Media. Support our important independent media work at patreon.com/leftfootmedia with just $5 or more per month, and you'll receive exclusive access to our full-length, patrons-only episode of the Dispatches podcast every single week. That's patreon.com/leftfootmedia. Link is in the show notes.